Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I know this is a line from an earlier age, but if you really want to know what's going on in Washington this week, follow the money. Financial reform is coming down to the wire, so the banking industry has pulled out all the stops. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 17th of May today. And it is probably more accurate to call all the bank lobbying that's going on in Washington this week intense rather than frantic. But there is a whole lot on the line. American banks are trying like heck to hang on to their share of the derivatives market. Those things like credit default swaps that did so much to make the credit crisis so much worse. Derivatives are worth more than $200 trillion to the entire financial industry. And there is some buzz today that all their pressure is working. Both Christopher Dodd, who chairs the Senate Banking Committee, and Arkansas's Blanche Lincoln, who heads the Agriculture Committee, say there is room to negotiate. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Just a few weeks ago, Senator Lincoln declared that banks backed with taxpayer guarantees shouldn't be allowed to wager at all in financial derivatives.
This is no time for small fixes or tweaking around the edges. This is the time for bold change and big decisions.
Since then, the Secretary of the Treasury, the head of the Federal Reserve, and the country's top banking regulator have lined up against her proposal, and now she's open to some tweaking. Robert Kuttner is a senior fellow with the advocacy group Demos. He says Lincoln's plan would give banks that want to keep trading in the lucrative but risky market a choice. Do it if you want, but without any promise of a bailout from Uncle Sam.
You are either a commercial bank with taxpayer guarantees, or you are an investment bank risking your own money. That's a nice, clear, bright line. If you depart too much from that, then the wise guys always find some way around it.
Derivatives were first devised as a way of insuring against losses on an investment, but Kuttner says many banks have made a lot of money wagering on things in which they haven't actually invested. He says it amounts to taking insurance out on your neighbor's home. Opponents argue that not all derivatives are bad and that the business actually makes the bank stronger and thus more able to lend. Scott Talbot is chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable.
Many people point to AIG, which is not a bank, which did not accept deposits, as being a leading cause. So to say we shouldn't allow banks to engage in derivative activity simply because another player did not use derivatives well seems to be throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Democratic leaders aren't saying where they might be open to compromise. Talbot's pushing for what he calls a more elegant measure. It would require banks to keep more cash on hand to cover possible losses. The debate on financial regulatory reform is entering its final week. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There are wire service reports this afternoon of a possible ceasefire in Bangkok, Thailand. Months of anti-government protests and 5 days of violence in the capital have left almost 40 people dead. Stories about it have made headlines all over the world. What we haven't heard much about, though, is the Thai economy. And that got us wondering, because 13 years ago, Thailand was where the Asian financial crisis got started. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
The ongoing street violence in Bangkok, captured on YouTube, is proof that Thailand may not be the wisest place to invest these days. The value of Thailand's currency, the baht, is steadily dropping, and officials from at least one neighboring country, Indonesia, publicly worry this could lead to a repeat of the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Morris Goldstein is a fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He says today's situation is nothing like 1997.
At that time, Thailand really acted as a wake-up call for investors to reappraise the situation in all of emerging Asia. And when they did that, they saw there were a lot of countries with extensive banking and financial sector problems.
So back in 97, we had a crisis that began in one small country, spread quickly across borders. Officials weren't on the ball, and pretty soon you had a regional economic crisis on your hands. Sound familiar?
The reason why Thailand hasn't got more ink is because of the larger crisis in Southern Europe.
The European debt crisis is overshadowing Thailand's current unrest, but Goldstein says Thailand won't affect the rest of Asia this time. Those countries implemented better banking standards after the 97 crisis. Standards, he says, that Southern European countries are now reviewing to try and clean up their economic mess. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Income inequality in this country, the wealth gap between rich and poor, has been growing for decades. A report out today from Brandeis University shows the disparity between whites and blacks at nearly all levels of income distribution has become dramatically larger over the past 25 years. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The study's author, Brandeis University's Tom Shapiro, says them that's got shall get.
The lion's share of the growth in the wealth pie for American families has gone to the highest income whites in this particular sample.
One reason for a fourfold increase in the wealth gap, he says, is tax policy. Assets are taxed less than earned income. He points to millions of dollars in exclusions from estate taxes as an example. Another reason, well-to-do African-American families are under more pressure to help their less well-off kinfolk.
Largely, the generality here is that among high-income whites, their family also tends to be high-income. Nephews and nieces and brothers and cousins don't ask them for as much help as the African-American community.
And finally, Shapiro points to lenders who charge poor people more for loans, subprime and payday loans and check cashing stores. He's hoping congressional regulatory reforms will make credit more affordable for poor people. But New York University economics professor Edward Wolf does his own survey of the racial wealth gap using data from the Federal Reserve.
My conclusion is that the racial wealth gap has not changed. It hasn't improved, which is too bad, but it hasn't changed in any case.
Wolf attributes the discrepancy to different data. He says the Federal Reserve's is better, but he agrees that tax rates and credit regulations are to blame for the lack of improvement in the racial wealth gap. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 200 points today and then got all of it back. Oil is down, gold is up, a little bit of everything in the markets today. Details, numbers, later on. Senate negotiators have really been scrambling the past couple of weeks, trying to come up with amendments to that financial reform bill that will cover all the news we've been getting about how Wall Street goes about its business. Goldman Sachs and the fraud lawsuit from the SEC, the market crash from a couple of weeks ago, and new investigations into banks and the ratings agencies. But if we have learned nothing else the past year and a half, it's that we really haven't learned anything about Wall Street yet. Michael Lewis has been writing about that section of Lower Manhattan for years now, most recently with his new book, The Big Short. Michael, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Let me start with the news from last week about Andrew Cuomo investigating banks for feeding bad information to the ratings agencies. Seems to me that what we've had the last, like, month or so is just drip, drip, drip of more of the same out of Wall Street.
I feel like what we've had the last month is a launching of a culture war with the SEC suit against Goldman Sachs and Cuomo's activity in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, all basically coming to the conclusion that now everybody wants to actually know how Wall Street firms make their money.
Well, that's a little scary because maybe we don't want to know, right? I mean,
I think we probably don't. Or rather, when we do, I think it's going to trigger a revolution in financial services. When people see how the bond market actually functions, and this is all about the bond market, important distinction. The bond markets overwhelm the stock markets in size and in their importance to the Wall Street firms. They're sources of enormous profitability. And you see there's a sort of, you say drip, 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 but I see this sort of natural progression in these lawsuits. And they're all with merit. I don't know if it's illegal for Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank or Merrill Lynch to game the ratings agency's model so they can get AAA ratings put on things that are actually junk, but it should be. And even if they end up getting off the hook legally, I think they're going to be on the hook for a new set of rules.
Do you actually have hope for the financial reform bill that's in Congress?
The way you phrase that question, I can tell what you think I should say. You think I should say no. But no, I do have. I have great hope. I'm actually, I don't want to put this too strongly, but almost proud of our Congress. They're grappling with these issues, and they're getting very entrepreneurial. The Franken Amendment, which is going to prevent the ratings agencies from essentially competing for the business of rating the bonds by lowering their standards, is a good example of the sort of thing that should happen.
So I was just thinking of how broad a brush we all use to paint Wall Street as if it's this one thing. But it's not. It's a bunch of really big companies and then many, many smaller companies who are doing all kinds of different things. When you talk to people who are in the financial industry, do you get a sense of relief that all of this is now coming out and the system is becoming more the way it's supposed to be?
Not in the bond markets. The people in the bond markets are disturbed and outraged. Their world's being turned upside down. On the bankers, the investment bankers and the mergers and acquisitions advisors and people in the stock markets, I think are relieved because, you know, they look at what happened and they say, we didn't have anything to do with this. We had these guys, these numbnuts in the bond departments who were doing this to our firms. And yeah, they made a lot of money in a few years and they paid themselves way too well, but they destroyed the firm. There is plenty of appetite for cleaning up the system inside the system. Now, having said what I just said, it's also true that if the reform is done well, the end result is a smaller, less profitable financial services industry.
Does Wall Street do what it was originally supposed to do? Does it do that anymore? You know, allocate capital and get companies to be able to get into the market and float their debt and then invest that money?
It obviously does it not so well. The point of Wall Street is to assess risks, make risks plain so capital can be allocated efficiently. And we've been through this period, this debacle that we're living through is the result of Wall Street having done precisely the opposite, having disguised the risk so capital could be misallocated and squandered. It's serving the purpose of enriching a handful of people who happen to work at the big Wall Street firms, but it's not serving the larger society and the productive economy. It's become divorced from that in some strange way. But this is a process that has taken, you know, this is a story that is not a story of the last 4 or 5 years, but a story of the last 25. And I think that's why the change now feels so wrenching and slow. I mean, we're changing something that's very sort of deeply embedded in our culture.
So it's going to take 25 years to unwind all this?
No, but 3 or 4. I mean, I think it's reasonable to expect that, just as after the crash of 29, it was 4 years before the Glass-Steagall bill was passed. It took 4 years to actually have decent hearings on the subject. It's going to take our society a little time to get our minds around what just happened. 3 or 4 years, that's fine by me.
Michael Lewis, his most recent book is called The Big Short. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
General Motors did something last quarter it hasn't done in 3 years. Actually, it made money. Almost $1 billion on the back of bankruptcy-related court costs and impressive sales, the company announced today. GM is also getting ready for its biggest new model rollout in years. The plug-in hybrid Chevy Volt debuts in November. Nissan's Leaf is going to roll out about a month later. And it could be the beginning of a radical change for American drivers, the transition from gas stations to cars powered by rechargeable electric batteries. If we're ready. Sarah Gardner reports from what is likely to be the number one market for electric cars in this country, Los Angeles, California.
If anybody in this city knows the tortured history of electric cars in America, it's Chelsea Sexton. She was a central character in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? Sexton is one of the most vocal advocates for electric vehicles in the country. So I was a little unsettled when she drove up to our interview in a Saturn.
Yes, well, that is one of the ironies. I, of all people, do not drive an electric car.
Sexton says electric vehicles, or EVs, are tough to find these days. Unless, of course, you have $100,000 to plunk down on a Tesla. Or you want a used Toyota RAV4, left over from the first but failed wave of EVs in the 90s. We found about 5 of them charging up in a parking lot at the LA airport.
There are several hundred of them still out there, still being used, still being loved, and they're holding up really, really well. They actually sell for, you know, $40,000, $50,000 still on eBay as used cars, and drivers are hanging on to them till there's something new available.
20 years ago, California tried to jumpstart the EV market with regulations, but failed. The effort did leave the state with over 1,000 public charging stations, though, so LA's ready to plug in, right? Not quite, says Sexton.
We actually skinned some knees in the 90s, and one of them was that every different vehicle back then used a different type of connector for the charger. And that was, as you might imagine, a royal pain.
Sexton says automakers are now uniting around one standard plug, but it doesn't fit these older charging stations, so they'll need retrofitting. The city of L.A. says it's going to do that and install more. Other cities like Seattle and Phoenix plan to do the same. But that's not the tough part.
The most important thing is to make sure that this is a good customer experience from day one.
That's Ted Craver, CEO of Edison International. They own Southern California Edison. Craver says most people will charge overnight at home. But last year, Edison discovered it can take more than a month to install that home capability. Since then, utilities everywhere have been working on that. Austin Buettner heads LA's public utility. He insists his customers won't be waiting.
You call us on Monday. By the next Monday, it'll be permitted, installed, and you can start charging.
Utility execs are also trying to get potential EV buyers to raise their hands now. They want to identify clusters of homes where electric cars may all be charging at the same time. Power companies may need to upgrade transformers to avoid blackouts. If they don't, they risk a backlash against EVs. And that's the last thing Mark Duvall wants to see. He's with the Electric Power Research Institute.
Well, I drove an EV1, and of course those were leased, so I had to give it back. I briefly considered chaining myself to it, but I felt that would be that would come back to haunt me at a later day.
Duvall does expect some speed bumps on the road to electric transportation, but he believes this time electric cars will stick with more than crunchy environmentalists and California car geeks.
This is something that resonates with a lot of the American population right now. No one believes that overdependence on petroleum is a good idea.
One of Nissan's early launch markets for the Leaf is even oil-friendly Houston. And L.A. activist Chelsea Sexton says there's more consumer choice this time, too, including next year's Fisker Karma, a plug-in sports car almost as pricey as the Tesla.
Fisker's also a $90,000 car, or in that ballpark, so again, out of my price range, very pretty.
Al Gore has signed up for one. Sexton says she'll be happy to settle for a Nissan Leaf or a Chevy Volt. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Those Fiskers are going to qualify for a big federal tax credit. You throw in state incentives if you've got them, and you can get the price down to a mere $78,000 or so. For more on EVs, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, Venezuela and its not-so-social social networking.
There's no transparency, free of speech, and media is very uncomfortable for them. A joke could put you in jail.
But first, let's do the numbers. After losing 180 points, the Dow Industrials average eked out a tiny gain. Closed up less than a tenth percent, 5 points, finished at 10,625. The NASDAQ picked up a third of 1%, 7 points, 2354 at the bell. The S&P 500 took home a tenth of 1%, that's 1 point, ended the day at 1136. Financial shares had double trouble, concern about the debt crisis in Europe and financial reform here at home. Citigroup withdrew more than 3%, J.P. Morgan Chase fell back a tenth percent, Goldman Sachs unloaded 0.4%. Oil prices dipped below a three-month low and oil shares fell right along with them. ConocoPhillips drained more than 1%. Chevron spilled more than 0.75%. ExxonMobil poured off a half of 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.49%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. By Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
Mm-hmm.
every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen. Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of April. The Labor Department releases its monthly producer price index. And multiple Senate hearings are scheduled to address issues related to the oil catastrophe in the Gulf. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. And this is a very big day in television land. Billions of dollars on the line. Today's the opening session of the annual ritual known as the upfronts, when networks preview their new fall shows for advertisers in the hopes of, selling them a couple of billion dollars worth of primetime ad space. The upfronts have been a pretty depressing event the past couple of years. But Jill Barshay reports that advertisers are feeling a bit better about spending this year, and not just on television either.
I'm at the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. The third-floor ballroom is filled with ad buyers. They represent McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, Budweiser. They're trying to guess which of NBC's shows will be hits and where to put their money.
This is the first presentation of the year, and money's already passing hands.
That's Brian Steinberg. He's the television editor at Advertising Age. He says some analysts predict TV ad spending will be up 10 to 20% this year. Tim Spengler is president of Initiative Media in North America. He buys print, internet, radio, and TV time for major advertisers. He's not quite so optimistic.
2010 is the beginning of a bounce back. 2009, arguably the worst year in the history of advertising. So it's a little bit more fun to be in a growing business again.
Spengler expects total corporate ad budgets to increase 2 to 4% this year. He says it will still be a few years before marketers return to pre-recession spending. What's interesting, he says, is where the ad dollars are now going.
Advertisers are allocating more and more of their monies to digital media, whether that be search or in niche websites.
Procter & Gamble, for example, is sponsoring podcasts for new mothers.
As part of our ongoing series, Me, My Baby, My World, that we're doing with Pampers, we decided today to celebrate Earth Day.
But there's no upfront market for podcasts, at least not yet. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is worried about the value of his country's currency, the bolivar. Inflation in Venezuela is increasing at its fastest pace in almost a decade. The black market in Caracas has bolivars worth only about half of the government-controlled official exchange rate. So yesterday, Chavez signed a tough new currency law. He announced police raids on illegal brokerages, and he told his supporters to send messages to his Twitter account if they want to turn currency speculators in. Yes, Hugo Chavez has a Twitter account with more than 300,000 followers. This is just the latest round in Venezuela's internet wars, one that Chavez and his opponents are spending millions of dollars to win. Rhys Ehrlich reports.
For many opponents of President Chavez, satire is the weapon of choice and the internet is the arena. El Chiguire Bipolar is one of hundreds of opposition websites that regularly rake Mr. Chavez over the coals. The site has an actor doing a dead-on imitation of the president and explaining that one of the most important duties of executive power is writing letters to Hollywood celebrities. The mock president asks Chavez supporter and actor Danny Glover to collaborate on a new film to be made in Venezuela.
Harry Potter y la derrota final del capitalismo.
It's called Harry Potter and the Defeat of Capitalism. The internet reaches about 30% of Venezuela's 27 million people. It has a significant influence on educated and upper-income people, just the sort with money to invest. But the young entrepreneurs who run this website have had trouble finding investors to expand their production company, according to one partner, Osvaldo Graziani.
Here in Venezuela, the private business are very, very cautious about putting money in that because they're afraid that they can close the companies.
Fear of the government is a problem for more established opposition media as well. Jaime Nestares is the general manager of Radio Caracas, an opposition radio station and website. The government refused to renew the company's television broadcasting license in 2007. Nestares says the radio station's internet operation continues to lose money, requiring subsidies from owners and investors.
The Venezuelan market for internet pages it didn't increase and grow the way that we thought in order to become a profit operation.
Nestares blames the bad financial climate on President Chavez, who he says wants to censor the internet as he has other media.
There's no transparency, free of speech, and media is very uncomfortable for them. A joke could put you in jail.
But Chavez supporters say he doesn't censor the media. The government allows access to all domestic and international websites, and it's set up more than 600 high-speed internet access centers in poor neighborhoods. Ava Gollinger edits the government-owned newspaper Correo de Orinoco International. She says the government is now channeling more resources into the web with a presidential Twitter and blog. It's even tackling the government's lackluster websites.
The websites that are out there also in Spanish and in English are not as sort of high-tech as others. I mean, just because resources haven't been allocated. The opposition has had an advantage. Now I think the tables are beginning to turn.
Indeed, President Chavez's tweets have become an instant success. Even some members of the opposition have signed up. In Caracas, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note today about how companies adapt to changing economic conditions. While the recession was at its worst, Sears beefed up its layaway programs as a way to keep customers spending. Now there is a new twist. The recession is easing, but there is still some nervousness out there that's got gold over $1,200 an ounce. So you can take your gold jewelry to Sears. They'll trade it in for you. You get cash that presumably you can spend at Sears. Most recent profit reports from that company, by the way, nothing less than 24 carat last quarter. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 5 points. That is less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 7 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 added 1 point. That is 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, how one building in Silicon Valley just cranks out the stars.
Why they say in real estate, location, 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 is because of the people who pass by there every day, the people who make the location special.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.